Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we are live from Bismarck, North Dakota, just about an hour from the main camp at Standing Rock. Well, the election is just 4 days away, and voter fraud is still making headlines, thanks to Donald Trump. Even though study after study has proven that voter fraud does not exist, it is still in the headlines. So where is the coverage about voter suppression, which is a much bigger problem than voter fraud? The nation's Ari Berman writes that Donald Trump's rigged election lies distract from the real threat to American democracy. Ari is senior contributing writer for The Nation, a fellow at The Nation Institute, and author of the book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Hi, Ari. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. And we're also discussing coverage of Standing Rock. I was supposed to fly home earlier this week, but because there are so many stories to tell here, I have decided to extend my trip. The national media are now flocking to Standing Rock, including ABC News, The Washington Post, and The Guardian. I was here about a month ago, and this time around, I am noticing a lot more television cameras. So what angles are the national media covering? What questions are they asking? And because the camp is getting larger and larger by day, are they specifically asking questions from Native Americans? Joining us to talk about this and coverage is Mark Trahant, independent journalist and journalism professor at the University of North Dakota, and he has been covering Standing Rock extensively. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
And Mark, I'm in Bismarck right now. How far are you from here?
About 4 hours.
Okay, 4 hours. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that was done well this week. So Mark, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I just listened to a piece by Sandy Tolan again. I mentioned him last time on The World. Excellent. It was just spot on coverage of what's going on at Standing Rock. There's also been just really outstanding Facebook reporting and live stuff. Jenny Monet is one who's done some great stuff. And I'm impressed with the stories you've been able to tell from Standing Rock. I think they've been really important ones that need to get out.
Well, thank you. I didn't read Sandy Tolan's latest piece. What was that one about?
It's an audio piece, and it just, again, puts the whole thing into that larger perspective of the narrative. And Sandy is just does a great job of distilling the important issues.
All right. Well, we will link to those stories at yourcallradio.org. Thank you, Mark. And we'll talk more extensively about Standing Rock later in the show. What about you, Ari? What's catching your attention this week?
As you can imagine, Rose, a week before the election, and you know, there's just been so many different voting problems already. We're not even at election day, and there's just a ton going on. And I think finally this idea that people are having problems being able to vote is finally breaking through in mainstream media coverage. We saw coverage, for example, that black turnout is down in North Carolina because Republicans there limited the number of early voting sites. We've seen lots of coverage in Texas of people wrongly being asked for strict forms of photo ID, even though that's not required. The Today Show actually had a good report yesterday by Ronan Farrow about Wisconsin voters who are not being issued photo IDs or having a lot of problems getting photo IDs to vote, based on reporting that I had done. So they talked about one woman who I had written about who was an Indian American U.S. citizen since age 8 who was told to spend $345 on her naturalization papers just to be able to cast a ballot. So we're seeing lots of these stories, and I think you know it's not getting nearly the amount of coverage it should be getting, but I think people are finally starting to understand that there is a real problem here. And the problem, as you said, is not that people are voting illegally, as Donald Trump is claiming. The problem is that people who have voted all their lives are showing up and now having a more difficult time voting because of all these new voting restrictions that have been put in place.
And Ari, because I'm here at Standing Rock, I haven't been spending that much time reading the election, which frankly has been a nice break. But I did do some research this morning about Donald Trump's claims about voter fraud, and the New York Times ran an op-ed by Dale Ho, director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project. The headline really says it all, and that is, "The Voter Fraud Lie We Can't Shake." I mean, this has been a claim for so many years. Is the media, are the media doing a better job of informing the public that study after study has proven that voter fraud does not exist?
They've been doing a better job recently because Donald Trump's claims have been so outlandish that I think the media has been doing a better job. For years, I was mentioning the fact that, for example, since the 2000 election, there have been only 31 cases of voter impersonation out of a billion votes cast, that you're more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to impersonate another voter. I've been talking about this stuff for years, but finally it seems like it's starting to be repeated by other people in the media who have been more aggressively fact-checking what Trump is saying. But I don't think they've gotten to the second part of the equation, which is that we do have a real problem. And the real problem is that there are laws in place to make it harder for certain people to vote, people who are disproportionately younger voters, lower-income voters, voters of color, whether that's through requiring strict forms of ID or cutting back early voting or making it harder to register to vote. But that is a real problem, and that these claims of voter suppression are not exaggerated, that they're very, very real. So I would love to see the media do a comparison. I wrote about North Carolina, for example. In 2014 in North Carolina, there were 2,300 documented cases of people who turned away from the polls because that state eliminated same-day voter registration and out-of-precinct voting, two seemingly minor reforms that, when they eliminated them, had a very big impact. So 2,300 documented cases of people who were turned away from the polls. There were only two cases of voter impersonation that North Carolina presented in court to justify its voter ID law. So you have 2,300 cases of people disenfranchised, only two cases of voter impersonation. I would love to see more people in the media make that comparison and say voter suppression is a much bigger problem than voter fraud. I don't think they've taken that step yet.
And Ari has been doing excellent reporting on this. He mentioned his piece about North Carolina. It's called "North Carolina Republicans Try to Disenfranchise a 100-year-old African-American Woman." Another one, a city clerk opposed an early voting site at UW-Green Bay because, quote, students lean more toward the Democrats. What's that one about, Ari?
So Wisconsin has been a battleground over a number of different voting issues. One of the things Wisconsin did was restrict early voting. Many of these early voting cuts were overturned by a federal court who found they were discriminatory against African Americans in cities like Milwaukee, but some cities still limited early voting locations and hours. And in Green Bay, Wisconsin, which is the third largest city in Wisconsin, there were major problems during the April 5th primary in Wisconsin at University of Wisconsin Green Bay's campus, where there was a polling place and there was 2-hour lines, and lots of students weren't able to vote because the lines were so long, and they had to go to class or they had to work. And so these students who were, you know, they had the college Democrats, the college Republicans, the college Libertarians, all asked for a polling place on campus. And the city clerk, who is appointed by a mayor that's very close to Governor Scott Walker, said, "No, I don't have the money. I don't have the ballot security. I can't put an early voting location on campus," which would alleviate the long lines. But we obtained emails through an open records request that showed that the city clerk wrote, in her words, that she didn't want to put an early voting site at Wisconsin Green Bay because, quote, "students lean more towards the Democrats." Which I thought was just an unbelievably outrageous statement. First off, she's supposed to be a nonpartisan city clerk. Secondly, college Republicans and college Libertarians asked for this, as well as college Democrats. And thirdly, we should be encouraging young people to vote. And if students are actually taking the initiative to lobby the city for an early voting location on campus, you think they would be rewarded for their civic activism, not penalized because there's a belief that more voting will benefit one party over the other. So this is a story that luckily got some pickup in Wisconsin and nationally, but it's just, you know, another example of how people are suppressing the right to vote for partisan reasons.
Ari Berman is a senior contributing writer with The Nation and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Mark Trahant is an independent journalist here in North Dakota. And Mark, you've been following this issue in Indian country. There's been some good reporting on this. Back in March, Mother Jones had a piece, Native Americans are taking the fight for voting rights to court. And then Indian Country Today has a piece also, Will Natives Get a Fair Chance to Vote in 2016? Not according to many lawsuits. This piece points out that in Montana, the Blackfeet Nation is pursuing parity between natives and non-natives for late registration access and absentee ballots. Here in North Dakota, tribal citizens are suing to overturn new restrictive voter ID laws. In Alaska, an historic lawsuit to improve voter access and language assistance in remote areas was settled. The called for changes must now be implemented. I mean, there's things going on in South Dakota, in Arizona. What about coverage of these really important issues in this angle?
Well, there's been some coverage. I think it's, and here in North Dakota, for example, those lawsuits, the tribal interests won. And in fact, I went to vote specifically carrying absolutely no ID just to make sure that it would work the way it was supposed to under the court order, and it went flawlessly. So I'm hoping that kind of translates. One of the flip sides of this story in North Dakota is that I urged early on that folks who have been at the Standing Rock camps for more than 30 days, North Dakota has no registration. So if you have residency for 30 days, you can vote. And you can register at the polls. And I think people should take advantage of that as much as possible. I also think there's a flip side story in Indian country, and that is that folks are taking advantage of early voting across the country in ways that are really interesting this election. Alaska, for example, is breaking all records for early voting. And curiously, the chief elections officer who was elected last cycle is Alaska Native, so maybe that's part of the push. Montana's had a great story. Montana, the Native vote actually is higher proportion in presidential years than the non-Native vote. And so folks are already engaged and turning out. So we'll see how that translates next week.
And Mark, Ari has been able to uncover some really unbelievable quotes from officials, politicians, basically saying, acknowledging, admitting that they're trying to prevent people of color from voting. Does the same thing happen in Indian country?
Oh, absolutely. I think Ari's reporting has just been fantastic. And some of the places are just continual problems. For example, Wisconsin and South Dakota, where it's almost a venal attack on Native voting rights. I think it's just one of those where you just gotta keep pressure on them and keep trying to write the stories and get them to shift the policy. I also think the bigger challenge for us, particularly in the Native community, is apathy and making sure that everyone who can vote does, and we're way low on that category, particularly across the country. So it's a combination of both.
Mark Trahant is an independent journalist here in North Dakota, and he's been covering what's happening at Standing Rock. We're talking right now about voting in Indian country, and Ari Berman is a reporter with The Nation, and he has done extensive reporting about voter suppression. Ari, what else can you tell us about what stands out for you? We talked about North Carolina. We talked about Wisconsin. What are you seeing in the national media? I mean, now that, you know, people are talking about, quote, voter fraud, what stands out for you in terms of good coverage about voter suppression and what people are doing about it?
So there has been, as I mentioned, some better reporting. There was something on the Today Show. There have been, you know, more coverage on MSNBC on with people like Chris Hayes and Joy Reid. And, you know, I'm going to be talking about it on Joy Reid's show this weekend and on Reliable Sources this weekend on CNN. So it's getting more coverage in the national media. Rachel Maddow has done a really terrific job of following this. So it's gotten a little bit more coverage. What's disturbing to me is, for example, after the third presidential debate, when Donald Trump said that he might not accept the election returns, CNN had on one of their mega panels, you know, where there's like 10 people on the panel, and they had some of these Trump surrogates who were just spouting the most unbelievable nonsense about dead people voting, about illegal immigrants voting, about all this stuff that has been thoroughly debunked. And on the one hand, yes, they had people on the panel like Van Jones, who were able to debunk it. And even the hosts like Anderson and Cooper were skeptical of it. But the fact that these people were given such a big platform to essentially just lie. You know, if I made up a bunch of lies, people wouldn't have me on TV. But if I'm a Trump surrogate and I lie all I want, well, suddenly I have this huge megaphone. And sure, Van Jones is going to debunk it. But you know what? The Trump people that are listening, it's not going to matter to them. They're just going to believe what they want to believe, regardless of the facts. So this he said, she said thing to me is still a huge problem. That you're, that the coverage says, well, one side alleges voter suppression, the other side alleges voter fraud, and let's argue it out. As opposed to saying, well, we can actually look at this empirically. We have lots of studies. We have lots of court hearings. We have lots of different things that we can look at to try to get some empirical data. And we know a lot about this. We know that these laws have reduced turnout. We know that people have been turned away from the polls. We know that certain communities are being targeted. And so I think that while there has been a lot of good coverage, this has still been covered in a haphazard and in far too often a he said, she said way.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because we're going to do a post-mortem on media coverage of this election. But when you step back and really think about what we have been subjected to in the last year, I mean, I think it's one of the most shameful moments in my lifetime, maybe with the exception of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But just everything we've been subjected to, so much fact-free coverage. It sounds even weird to say that. But Ari, when you look back at this year and this election cycle, how are you analyzing media coverage?
Oh, well, it's been awful, Rose. I mean, you're right. It's really has been. The political climate in this country and the media coverage is the worst that it's been since the invasion of the war in Iraq, when everyone just supported the war despite all the evidence to the contrary that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction and there was no really good reason why we needed to do this. The media, first off, particularly cable news, created Donald Trump. I don't think there's any doubt about it. NBC created his celebrity TV identity with The Apprentice, and Fox News first created his political identity with him going on Fox and Friends all the time and talking about all the birther nonsense, and then he got so much more coverage both during the primary campaign where they covered everything he did, and then during the general election. I mean, Hillary Clinton got almost no coverage, and when she did get covered, it was, you know, usually negative coverage about her emails. And I think there's good reason to be skeptical of both candidates. I think the media should cover them skeptically, but it was just so disproportionate in terms of how it seemed like they were being covered. So they gave Trump a totally free rein, and then only then, when he did really outrageous stuff, only when, for example, the tapes came out of him, you know, boasting about sexual assault, did people sort of start to pull back. But I think that cable news in particular has been extremely complicit in this election. The coverage of the FBI has been totally irresponsible. The fact that there was basically nothing in this letter from James Comey, but it was blown, it was covered like it was World War III. So I've been really disappointed, but I think cable news is the real problem. I think that, you know, most newspapers have done a good job. Most magazines, the independent media has done a good job. I think really cable news, which unfortunately is where most people get their news, has really skewed everything.
Mark, what about you? What's your analysis?
Well, I could not agree more with the general thesis, but I think it actually is a huge problem with discourse in America, and it's not just this particular election, but the idea of our DNA is based on this idea of objectivity, which never existed, and yet we cling to it, and so we cover things like climate change and official sources as if they're equal at all times, and they're just not. I'll give you a great example from Standing Rock. The sheriff has been saying, and the governor both of North Dakota have been saying things that are just flat out not true, and yet they continually get repeated, and the media goes to them as the main sources on what's going on, when their credibility now should be challenged every time because of what they said in the past, and that's just not happening. Climate change, we should be having some sort of balance, would be like 97-3, and yet we still think of 50-50 coverage, and it's just absurd.
And Mark, I just want to let listeners know, I drove from where the Standing Rock Camp is, which is about an hour from Bismarck, North Dakota. And I'm here at the local public radio station, and they do carry NPR shows, but I can't get it. 90.3. It's completely just cannot get it in Bismarck. And the only person I was able to listen to this morning was Rush Limbaugh. You've got like five religious stations on the FM dial. Some of them are talking about voting and praying on election day. But you can't get news here on the radio. It's kind of been shocking.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's really interesting. I both in North Dakota and Minnesota, when we drive across, we're able to get public radio, so I'm surprised in Bismarck. But one of the great things about this part of the world that I should mention is that on AM we also get CBC.
Oh, you do? Okay, well, I'll have to try to find
that. That's the great antidote.
Well, can you talk a little bit about just local media and how local media are covering these issues, specifically voter suppression, Indian Native media? How are they covering that?
Native media has been trying to just do catch-up, so when there's a court action, they'll write about that, and there's just not a lot of resources to do anything investigative of that nature. My Native Vote project is just so overwhelming that I haven't done nearly as much as I should have. But I'm just trying to keep track of 100 candidates, so that's kind of all I can do. The local mainstream media is basically understaffed. The water protectors have felt that they've been biased all along, and I think there's some truth to that, but I think the bigger problem is they just don't have any resources. When this whole started, if I were running a newspaper or a radio station or a TV station, I would have had someone at that camp permanently and said, I want stuff every day, and no media has done that from this region. So I think that's just a flaw in their planning and their execution.
I don't think any national media outlet has done that either. I know reporters will fly in for 3-4 days and then leave.
Right.
I don't think anyone's been here longer than a week.
I think that's not good enough for a story this big. You really need someone that can get the ebb and flow. There are just so many stories that have yet to been told. And
right.
Partly they have this complexity that you just can't do by flying in and out.
And Ari, I know that you're completely covered and focused on the election right now, but what are your thoughts on coverage of Standing Rock, just based on what you've read?
I mean, it seemed to me that, you know, people like Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Were way out in front in covering this story. And, you know, you guys can tell me more about it. But it seemed like it was being driven by people on the ground. It seemed like it was being driven by tenacious, independent journalists like Amy, and then basically was being ignored by, you know, much of the media. And this is a trend here when it comes to these things, when it comes to things like Occupy or Standing Rock or fights over other activist movements, that basically, you know, they're ignored, they're thought of as unimportant. If they're covered, sometimes they're ridiculed by the mainstream media, and then suddenly everyone realizes, like, oh, maybe this is an important story, and they parachute in there, they cover it for a few days, and then they forget about it. So I think it's an unfortunate trend that we've seen over and over and over. And I think, generally speaking, issues, to me, and I'm guilty of this as much as anybody, but coverage of what's happening with Native Americans, covering what's happening with Indian country, is extremely, extremely important, and something that we've ignored for far too long, even though there's lots of serious issues there.
Mark?
Well, I absolutely. I'm not sure how to respond to that except to total agreement. I don't think you can understand the story of America without understanding how American Indians and Alaska Natives fit into the narrative. And the story at Standing Rock is one that goes back 2 centuries, and it's part of the original sin of the country. The idea that you would have chief law enforcement officers for both the county and the state government say, enforce the law, when the tribe is holding up a treaty with the United States of America, and the Constitution says treaties are the supreme law of the land. I mean, you could just start with that. It really is extraordinary that this... I'm stunned, really, that television is finally getting the word that this is a great story, because any television person that has any sense would look at this, look at the facts on the ground, and see this is just a brilliant story, one that's got so many dimensions and worth rich for telling. And so I'm surprised, really, that it's taken so long, because this is the kind of story that just gets people excited, because It really is the great American story.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And Ari, before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
So I am headed to Wisconsin on Monday for the election, and I'm going to be, you know, focused on telling stories of people who are having a hard time voting, who either had a hard time getting IDs or weren't able to get IDs at all, or had to wait in very long lines because early voting was cut, or any other number of reasons. And so while the media has been focused so much on who people are going to vote for, you know, I've been asking a completely different question, which is everyone actually going to be able to vote? And I'm afraid that's not going to be the case, and so I think it's really important to document this to the extent that we can, because I don't think this is just a political issue. I think it's really morally scandalous that in the year 2016, people are still being disenfranchised.
Well, thank you for your reporting, Ari. We're doing actually a live broadcast on election night to offer independent analysis, and we'd love to check in with you just to find out what voters have gone through throughout the day. So
sounds good. Let's
we can connect with
let's
you on
be
that.
In touch. I'll probably be somewhere in Wisconsin, but hopefully,
well, we'd love to check in with you. All right.
Sounds
thanks
good,
for
Rose.
Your work, Ari.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. Ari Berman is senior contributing writer with The Nation and author of the book Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Mark Trahant will be sticking with us for the rest of the hour. He's an independent journalist here in North Dakota. And after the break, we will discuss media coverage of Standing Rock. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, Inflection Point, host Lauren Schiller will talk with filmmaker and Webby Award founder Tiffany Schlain about the issue of true equality for men and women. Stay with us here on 91.7 KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will be live from Bismarck, North Dakota, just about an hour from the main camp at Standing Rock. And I'll be joined by young Native Americans who are here joining the struggle. I just interviewed a couple yesterday who were arrested. A number of young people, actually young runners, are expected to arrive today. They've been running from Arizona. So maybe we can get one of those young runners on the show on Monday. But I hope you can tune in for that. And then on election night, if you are free, we hope you can come to the Roxy in the Mission in San Francisco. We'll be doing a live broadcast with independent analysis from 7 to 9 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. The address is 3117 16th Street. It's a free event. And then Ben Trefney will be back in the KALW studios taking your calls from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock p.m. Find more information at kalw.org. And also, if you're still reading through all of the measures and propositions that we're voting on, check out KALW's election guide. There's a great printout there that you can take with you to the polls with a list of all the props and the measures, so you don't have to take that really thick ballot guide with you. And today we are live from Bismarck, North Dakota. We're talking about what is happening here at Standing Rock and ongoing coverage. I'm noticing that a lot more media are here this time. I was here last month, and I decided to extend my trip this time around because there are just so many incredible stories to share, and I'm seeing a lot more television cameras this time. ABC News, The Guardian is here, The Washington Post, and then a lot of independent journalists. And we're speaking with Mark Trahant, an independent journalist and journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. And now I would like to welcome back Annette Pember, an independent journalist focusing on Native issues for Indian Country Today and other publications. Hi, Mary. Thank you for joining us again.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. So, Mary, what really strikes you now that Standing Rock is getting so much attention in the national media, from NPR to the Washington Post, ABC News? What stands out for you?
Well, just that they're covering us. I mean, I think they kind of got shamed into it with, you know, when Amy Goodman did from Democracy Now, you know, showed those dogs fighting those Indians, and they're like, oh my God, we better get out there. And you know, it's become a bigger issue, and certainly social media has just been driven by that, and which I think is just, it's so inspiring to me, and what, you know, how things are, how our media world is changing. You know, young folks, I'm just so inspired and impressed by them. You know, one of the things I was thinking about, I remember a poster back in the 60s or 70s of, I think, sort of during the Black Panther era of a young woman with her fist in the air saying, smash the state and build something beautiful in its place. And I think, you know, I think folks are, they're not bothering to smash the state because, well, as far as like mainstream media, it's kind of already imploded on itself. You know, especially, you know, newspapers, but they're building something beautiful and like right next door, and it's being embraced, and it's just really lively and exciting.
We have an email from Sandy in Oakland who says one thing she has noticed in the national media, even in the Bay Area, are interviews of non-natives instead of natives. She says the exception has been Lawrence O'Donnell, who has had the Standing Rock chair Dave Archimbault on the show. Now, I think this is really interesting because I was watching a video the other day of, I think it was the Young Turks, about the incident that just happened on Tuesday or Wednesday, people being pepper sprayed by the water, and I noticed 90% of the people in that video were white. And I'm here at Standing Rock, and a lot of people are coming in, mostly non-native, to express solidarity, which is fantastic. That's what people here say. You know, it's great. But Mark, what about that? What about the media's responsibility to ensure that they interview natives here at Standing Rock?
Well, I don't think you can tell the story accurately if you don't start there. I think you really, this is been driven startly by both tribal members and tribal government, and you almost have to start there. I should mention, too, since Mary's on, that Mary Annette Pember has been just done some fantastic stuff in Indian Country Today Media Network, and it's a great place to start if you're looking for kind of the get a flavor of what's going on and really human stuff that tells stories that just aren't being told. In terms of the national media, I mean, it works both ways. In one sense, there's not enough reporting and sourcing from people who are from Indian country. On the other hand, yesterday the national story about religious leaders being arrested at the state capitol made it look like it was folks from the camp again, rather than focusing on leaders who came in for this particular reason. And so the media kind of gets it wrong on both scores, unfortunately. I think it's, again, reflects not having the complexity because they're just not there enough.
Mary, what would you add?
Oh, I just thank you for your kind words. Mark and I go way back, and he was a mentor to me in many ways in the early days, so thank you. You know, and I was actually recently at a journalism and women's symposium, and primarily made up of mainstream journalists, but women journalists. And I was seated at a table of young women of color, journalists of color, and you know, I felt like, and the stuff that they were talking about, the sort of challenges they have in the newsroom, and I thought, what, you know, what am I, like Rumpelstiltskin? It's like I could close my eyes and it's the same conversation I could have heard back when I was starting in the 80s. You know, one, that there aren't enough faces of color in the newsroom and, you know, and at news meetings when they're making these decisions. And people still aren't gathering sources from communities of color. They're still saying crazy things, like if they're doing a story, for instance, that has, you know, an African-American element, oh, let's send somebody out to the barber shop and get a comment. I mean, they still, rather than, you know, having those, you know, more deep sources, let's go speak to a physician who's African-American or, you know, or Native American or for whatever community that may be, you know, important in that particular case. So it's like this, still the same sort of, it's still sort of institutions talking to other institutions. And I think, you know, mainstream media is, you know, they're pretty conservative folks. They're not risk takers, you know, and people want to keep their jobs, and which I can surely appreciate in these uncertain times, but they just continue to miss the mark, like a really important mark. And people are just kind of going on without them. You know, they're just finding out stuff on their own.
Well, we've got a couple of emails, and if you'd like to email us, it's feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call if you have any questions or comments about media coverage of Standing Rock, 866-798-8255. And again, email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Annie writes in, I heard on an NPR show that the tribe at Standing Rock was invited to have their point of view represented early on during the process a number of times, but they did not participate. I would like to know if this is true or not. Mark, can you take that?
Who did you say?
Mark, can you take
that
one?
It's more complicated than that. The Army Corps of Engineers had a process in place, but it was basically, if you want to boil it down, to let's go get yelled at by people at Standing Rock. It was designed to go in and say, we're going to do this regardless of what you think. Federal consultation requires a back and forth where people actually have a conversation and negotiations about what it's going to look like, and that clearly did not happen. It's important to remember that this entire project was designed to avoid regulation. Whether it be the tribal input or the federal input, the project was designed to avoid environmental impact statements or any kind of substantial consultation.
So what about including that important information in the reporting? Are you seeing that?
It certainly is in my reporting. Not enough.
What about
again, it goes to this idea of who the sources are. The state and the sheriff's office and the Corps of Engineers get extra weight when they're dealing with national sources, when in fact what they're saying is just not accurate.
Can you elaborate on that? The New York Times, for example, ran a story on October 28th, tension between police and Standing Rock protesters reaches a boiling point. And it really was a he said, he said. So it was the officers gave their perspective, and then water protectors gave their perspective. It just went back and forth.
And that's been a problem. I mean, if you were to do a chart and to go back and look at who said what over the period of time since this started, and to see then who's been accuracy and doing like kind of accuracy measure every day, it's no question in my mind that the folks at the camp would be the ones on the accuracy side. Just one example with the sheriff. He was forced into pursuing a criminal investigation for the dog handlers, and all along he kept saying that he didn't know who they were. And yet on social media, people are looking at pictures of him showing the dog handlers around his jail. I mean, there's just discrepancies that aren't being vetted the way you would do normally with a story. The idea of the old Chicago rule of journalism, if your mother says she loves you, check it out, is not occurring with state officials in this case.
And Mary, what are your thoughts? The New York Times had another piece called The View from Two Sides of the Standing Rock Front Lines. And Mikasi Horonek, an activist, was interviewed. And then under that, John Mole, a sheriff's deputy, was interviewed. He said folks in the area are terrified. And I'm thinking, what, terrified of what? I mean, people are in the camp the whole time. So I don't understand what they're terrified of. He's saying that ranchers and people in the area are terrified.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because I was exactly wondering that. And I did call up this little bar that we had driven by when I was with one of the actions that the water protectors went on. I went out to report on it. And it's a little bar. It's just, there's no paved road. And so I called them up and I said, so, you know, what do you guys think of all this? And again, they're really scared. And I'm like, well, of what? You know, they're scared of people being in their yard. This was the woman told me, they had a neighbor, and she had called up an elderly neighbor, and she was very frightened because these protesters were in her yard. I said, oh, well, what were they doing? Well, they were in her yard. So I don't know. I think there's a different level or something in North Dakota. I got the sense that if more than like three cars were to drive by this lady's house, she would get kind of freaked out. I think some of it is, you know, and also, you know, and I did also ask the sheriff, you know, I was hearing about all these crimes being reported. I said, well, can you give me a list? Well, he couldn't. There was a lot of calls, but there was actually no reports of crimes. The other thing, here's the interesting thing. There's been a story from, I don't know, what is it, like the Ranch Association regarding cattle rustling. And you know, I've never agriculture has never been a beat that I've covered in my career. So I got to thinking, gosh, I wonder, wow, is this new? And turns out, cattle go missing all the time around there. It's not unique to this particular time. And that's not been reflected in the reporting. And I do think, you know, there was a report of 30 cattle were rustled from one particular rancher. And I think, you know, if there were 30 cattle at these camps, I think we'd see them. I think somebody would see them. I mean, those Indians are pretty good at butchering, but they're not that good, you know. So there's not, you know, so I'm saying there's, yeah, people aren't asking these kinds of follow-up questions that I'm in any newsroom that I've ever been in. I think that I would be expected to ask.
Just given the amount of surveillance, if there was even one cow being butchered, there would be photographs on Facebook within 10 minutes. And that's another, actually, aspect, is the way the sheriff is using Facebook goes well beyond the role of law enforcement. For example, trying to make this about out-of-state agitators, it really sounds like language from the 1960s in the Deep South.
Well, I've been reading quotes from people who have said that most of the people at Standing Rock are not from here. And I have met so many people who are from here, who are members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. One man I met yesterday said, look, there's our flag. It's all over the camp. There are so many of us are here. Maybe not all of us are sleeping here, but we're coming here every day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Today we are talking about media coverage of what's happening at Standing Rock. What really strikes you about what you've seen and heard? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Mark Trahant, who is an independent journalist and a journalism professor with the University of North Dakota. And we're also joined by Mary Annette Pember, an independent journalist focusing on Native issues for Indian Country Today. We've got a few emails about NPR's coverage. Greg says NPR has been late to get involved in this. Have either of you been covering or listening to NPR's coverage? Mark, have you?
Yeah, I've actually heard some pretty good stories out of NPR. It was late, but I think lately they've been doing fine. I'm still struck by the People's Network at Public Television, how they've not been there as much as they should be. But I think NPR actually did okay.
What about you, Mary?
Yeah, I agree. And well, yeah, they're late. I mean, and the other thing, I mean, it's a pretty remote area. I mean, one has to think of that. And it's we are looking at, you know, again, these large institutions that have to make decisions regarding, you know, their allocations of funds and travel money. So, I don't know, that would be my defense to them, but I think they've been doing a decent job.
Well, I wanted to share some news that I just learned. So over the last week, I have been interviewing people who were arrested during Thursday's violent crackdown. I've interviewed elders, young people, and everyone in between. A number of people have been telling me that DNA samples have been taken after their arrests. And I was unable until now to finally get this confirmed. I just got an email from Rob Keller, who is with the Morton County Sheriff's Office. He says it is state mandated that anyone in North Dakota arrested for a felony shall submit a DNA sample. Almost everyone arrested on Thursday had DNA taken because they were felony arrests. So this is just breaking news that's coming down. I've interviewed people who've been DNA tested, but I could not get it confirmed. The state attorney's general's office told me that it's not under their jurisdiction. I finally got a call back from the North Dakota's governor's office this morning. They said they have no comment, but I was able to get it confirmed from the Morton County Sheriff's Office. So, Mark, what's your response? I mean, the next question I'm going to start trying to find out is, where's this DNA being stored and why? Why is DNA being taken?
Continually shaking my head about the reaction from the whole law enforcement mechanism in the county and the state, and it's just, it's sad. It really is a crazy overreaction and felony charges that are really ridiculous over and over and over. It's interesting to me, I got a phone call from a journalist in Vancouver, BC, who covers the oil and gas industry, And he was telling me how disappointed the entire industry is at the coverage coming out of North Dakota, because they think that the way the state has handled it and the way Energy Transfers has partners have handled it undermines their own cause. And they think that even they think that this has just been abysmal in the way it's been mitigated.
Mary, a number of, well, men too, the women that I've interviewed are so traumatized still from being held in jail for 3 days. A 69-year-old woman I met had her ID and Medicare card taken, and she now has pneumonia and can't get her meds because she doesn't have her ID. She's traumatized, but she's going back to the camp. She's been camping for 3 weeks. A lot of people I've interviewed have said, you know, we were so shaken by the military response, and then we were taken to jail. We weren't processed for 5 or 6 hours, and then we were transported another 3 hours. So by that time, we didn't even ask questions about the DNA. They all said that they weren't read their rights. So what about this? I mean, this needs to get out there.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, you want to talk about unfair treatment of Native peoples by law enforcement, and the whole trauma issue as well. A big issue, and it's going to have long-standing impacts. I mean, I felt kind of freaked out after being there with my son for several days, and, you know, and I would see a helicopter, and it's very, I mean, it's just so overkill to a level that it's just, it's so shocking. You know, I mean, they're wearing all these, I mean, they could be in like in this like war zone. I mean, the kind of battle fatigues, and then these enormous armored vehicles. You know, I think it was a case of somebody on the water protector side threw like poop at him. And I was thinking, well, it'd probably be good to have like a face shield or something. But I mean, it's just, you know, considering when we look at like in comparison of, you know, the situation in Malheur in Oregon, you know, those folks had for real guns. You know, they were waving American flags and they were not Indian, but they had real guns that they were pointing at police. And that to me would have made a little bit more sense to have this sort of enormous protection. But just the responses, I mean, it's really frightening coming up over a hill and just seeing this enormous line, you know,
right,
of these basically soldiers. Yeah, it's pretty shocking.
And at the camp last night, I mean, there are several very bright lights. The construction is happening 24/7, and you have to see it all night. I mean, it's right in your face. There are military vehicles up on the hills. The pipeline is essentially being protected by police. Now, here's another question that I have not been able to receive answers to. I wonder if either of you have. I asked the Sheriff's Department public information officer, how much is this costing the state every day, and how long will these police be protecting the pipeline? I can't get answers. Mark, have you been able to get any answers?
Well, they just asked for another $4 million from the emergency fund, so it's a cost at least $10 million so far, because they asked for $6 million before. I think the costs are just beginning. You're looking at long-term trials. You're looking at civil rights lawsuits based on what the actions of the department and how they've handled people. You're looking at a whole host of things. And what's striking to me, and every taxpayer in North Dakota should be upset about, is this is done for a corporate benefit, not for the public good.
Well, let's take a call before we have to end. Let's hear from Philip in San Francisco. Hi, Philip.
Hello, this is Paul.
Oh, hi, Paul.
All right, well, thanks a lot for reporting from there. It's an excellent reporting that I've been able to pick up from Facebook. I just want to say people can support the occupation or the stand at Standing Rock in other ways from home. By there's a website, how to contact the people who send militarized police to Standing Rock, and people can call the different sheriffs, different politicians in the area whose forces are going in there against the protectors of the water. You want the website?
If you can send it to feedback@yourcallradio.org, we'll put it on our website.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right.
And Mary, I wanted to also ask you just about the human side of all of this, because that tends to get lost with the focus on the violence and the arrests. A lot of young people that I've been interviewing have said, you know, our parents and our grandparents have not been very comfortable speaking out because of the boarding schools, but we are speaking out. I met an older man yesterday who said, that's right, we've all been traumatized by the boarding schools, but this has really kind of made me proud of my identity and who I am. And you've been reporting on the human side. Can you talk about the importance of not letting that get lost with the arrest and the violence?
Well, not sure really what you're asking. Just in terms of, I think it's been a really empowering opportunity for a lot of people. I mean, I reported on this young woman who just gave birth to a baby last month. And, you know, she knew she was pregnant, obviously, and she chose to go and she planned for it. And for her, it's been an act of resistance. And talking to this young woman, I mean, and she's not, she has several children also there with her young children, and she's chosen not to go out on the actions, to stay with her children, and she has a teepee there, and she cares for them. And just that, you know, that act of staying there with her children, caring for them, sending them to the water protector schools, is like this profound act of resistance. You know, she's taken reproductive rights back. You know, for many, our Native women have a history of being sterilized against their will up until the 70s, you know, and our reproductive rights were not our own. That is, you know, that's like a really profound story to me.
Hmm.
There's a lot of really wonderful things that people are really caring for themselves. I mean, there's a lot of existing trauma, I think, and then more immediate trauma from going out in the actions, and also just being like constantly being buzzed by these, you know, these aircraft. But you do get the sense that, I mean, this could be like a real watershed event for us, for Native peoples, in a lot of really good ways. I mean, that we
right.
are coming forward. We're caring for ourselves in ways that are meaningful to ourselves. I was just talking to actually one of the medics, and if they have, you know, like an emergency situation, they're kind of reluctant in some ways to call, particularly like a mental health situation, to call like Morton County emergency services to come down, because the people are afraid. They don't want to go with them, you know, and they have to, so, you know, they've kind of have made an arrangement so that the ambulances will stop outside at the gate. But I mean, just to have an awareness of that's like, it's just like, oh, the very people that have traumatized me, now you're going to give me to them. I'm not comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. But I think that people are caring for themselves is that's really inspiring. And I think, you know, I think a lot of good things will emerge from this.
Well, that's what I keep hearing here at Standing Rock, and we will continue to cover this. Today, we've been joined by Mary Annette Pember, independent journalist focusing on Native issues for Indian Country Today and other publications, and Mark Trahant, independent journalist and journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. Mary and Mark, thanks for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Let's do it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Native American youth about their role in the struggle against the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. Thousands of Native youth from tribes across the country have joined the growing movement at Standing Rock. So what challenges are young Native Americans facing today, and how does the mass mobilization here in North Dakota connect with their broader struggles? Join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, a third-party presidential form of Jill Stein of the Green Party and Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party's candidate, and Richard Jackson on the connection between built environments and our health, plus songwriter Carol Bayer Sager on her memoir, They're Playing Our Song, on the next Tavis Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tavis heads your way at noon here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco, where a number of local businesses provided us with some snacks and treats for our volunteers and our staff during our recent membership drive, including Casa Sanchez for chips and their famous salsas, and Veritable Vegetable for boxes of organic Satsuma tangerines. Next time you visit, please thank them for supporting this local radio station. Visit KLW.org to find links to their establishments. It's 11 o'clock.
I want to live to see a 50-50 world, and will all of this connectedness accelerate the pace of change? Because, listen, from the moment we got the right to vote, you know, we're now hopefully going to see our first woman president. That's 100 years. I don't want to wait that long to see a 50. I want to be alive to see it.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point, conversations with women who are changing the status quo. That was Emmy-nominated filmmaker, founder of the Webby Awards, and one of Newsweek's Women Shaping the 21st Century, Tiffany Schlain. We'll talk with her about achieving true 50-50 equality for women and men.